So let's start chapter 4 then, which is about cells and organelles. I've said several times that all organisms are related if you go back far enough in time, because we all are descendants from an original cell. So the question is, how does that original cell come to be? Nowadays, this is a fundamental part of cell theory. Nowadays, all cells come from pre-existing cells. So cells don't just pop into existence anymore. But then that demands an answer to the question, how did the original cell get to be if it takes a cell to make new cells? Well, the original cell didn't just pop into existence either. In other words, what we call a cell is a little bit more complex than the first things that were protocells needed to be. You're not going to be able to have anything like a cell, though, if you don't have organic compounds to work with, because that's the stuff that all cells are made out of, right? And early on in Earth's history, well, almost a billion years, actually, after Earth already existed as a planet. How old is Earth? 4.6 billion or so years, yes. And for all, you know, several hundred million years in early Earth history, there was no cells. And there also weren't, actually, the organic macromolecules that cells are even made out of yet. The mixture in the ocean was pretty simple set of chemicals. And so in the 50s originally, there was a famous experiment conducted to demonstrate that the early Earth conditions were such that organic macromolecules can spontaneously form without any life, in other words. And that's what's being done here in this setup, that you make a simulated atmosphere with what we are pretty sure the early atmosphere contained, various simple hydrocarbons and water and hydrogen gas and so on. And there are some electrodes in there that you can spark every once in a while to simulate lightning, which occurs a lot of time if you wait hundreds of millions of years. And if you run this thing for a while, oh, and you also heat it, because Earth was a very, very hot place originally. If you let this run with spark and heat and eventually come back and take a sample of the liquid, you find things like amino acids and other organic compounds that are required for the various macromolecules that we've been talking about. So the raw materials eventually would have been created just by the conditions. And that doesn't make a cell, of course, but on slide 2 we can see what we've already talked about, really. Namely, that once you have those phospholipids, they will spontaneously form membrane-like structures, right? Well, they will form membranes. It just won't be a full-blown cell membrane yet. It's not really a cell that we're looking at here. It's more of a micelle, as it's called, M-I-C-E-L-E. Two L's. M-I-C-E-L-L-E is a micelle. And this is happening only because of the fact that phospholipids are amphipathic, right? For reasons I've already described. So that makes the first cell-like thing. And this happened over and over, I'm sure, usually with no consequence. But at the same time, you're starting to have RNA formed spontaneously as well. And once you start having these randomly formed micelles that just happen to engulf RNA, now you're getting closer to something that's a cell. The original nucleic acid almost certainly was RNA. So we went through an RNA history before we even got to DNA. RNA is simpler for one thing. That's one reason this makes sense. But also, you can't have a cell without proteins, right? Proteins, like I've been saying, do all the important functions. Well, proteins don't easily just pop into existence, even though amino acids do. In other words, to polymerize those amino acids into a polypeptide, really, if you're going to have that happen to an appreciable degree, you're going to need the help of some sort of catalyst. And RNA, most catalysts in cells nowadays are proteins. Those are what we call enzymes, right? So how do you make proteins which require catalysts if you don't have the enzymes, which are themselves proteins? Well, you can use a different kind of catalyst. For instance, certain kind of clays. If the materials are washed up onto a clay surface, sometimes that can be a catalyst. Also, though, RNA operates as a catalyst under certain circumstances, which is why we eventually, once we learned this, came up with a different word, right? What is an enzyme that is made out of RNA instead of protein called? It's not an enzyme unless it's a protein. An RNA-based catalyst is called a ribozyme. It's an important component of a ribosome, right, which requires catalytic activity in order to make that polypeptide, which is the major job of a ribosome. So this is another strong bit of evidence saying that RNA was the original nucleic acid. The problem with RNA is that since it's single-stranded, it's not very stable. So once you had enough stuff going, enough cells made, eventually DNA took over because the double-stranded nature of DNA keeps it from reacting with things and therefore makes it a lot more stable and therefore maintains the integrity of the information. Okay, now to three. So eventually there was some cell that actually had just the right components that it could start making new cells, and that's the cell that I talk about when I say we all have that one cell in common. Not to say that there was one cell that was immediately successful, but eventually a cell happened and we all came from that one. We now recognize three domains of life, and those are listed here in slide three: bacteria, archaea, and eukarya. We talked about this before. Domains are the broadest classificatory units. They're the broadest taxa, in other words. A taxon is some group of organisms. And so each of these domains is huge, includes a huge number of species, but it makes sense to lump all of life into three domains because each domain is sufficiently different from the other ones to actually put them in their own domain. So as you go down this list, and I'm not going to read this whole thing to you, or I don't want you to memorize all this, but you notice that in certain things, archaea and bacteria are similar. In certain things, they're not. Certain things, archaea and eukaryotes are similar. Certain things, they're not. And for some things, they're just all three different. So there's all kinds of actual evidence pointing to three domains, which is why we made three domains. But as it turns out, as you see in slide four, even though archaea and bacteria, which are combined to form the prokaryotes of the world, they're all single-celled and don't have membrane-bounded organelles. And so even though they look very similar to each other, and if you were just look at an archaean or a bacterium under a microscope, without being an expert, you'd say, yeah, these are the same thing, basically. So even though they look very similar, it turns out, phylogenetically speaking, based on ancestral history, that is, that archaea and us eukarya are actually more similar to each other than either one is to bacteria. And so you can see from this phylogenetic tree that the original cell lineage eventually split into one lineage that makes up the whole bacteria domain, and the offshoot of that is the lineage that is the ancestor to both us and archaea when we split back here. So now you have the three domains, but archaea and eukarya are more closely related than either is to bacteria. All right. not a five. In five, we're investigating the notion of surface area to volume ratio. And so I said a little bit ago that cells come from pre-existing cells. Well, there are plenty of unicellular organisms out there. In fact, most organisms that have ever existed have been unicellular. Most organisms that exist right now are unicellular. Most organisms that have ever existed and that exist right now are specifically bacteria. That has always been the case, and it likely always will be the case. But we tend to think about ourselves and big things like us. Huge organisms are comparatively rare, even though there's still a lot of them. But a huge organism like a human is not huge because the cell that that human started out as just got huge. In other words, you don't have big organisms by drastically increasing the size of a cell. You don't have huge cells. There are some exceptions that are much bigger than most other cells, but you can't make a huge cell by growing it in all three dimensions. And the reason you can't is because if you think about this mathematically, the surface area of an object grows as the square of its dimensions, right? Whereas the volume grows as the cube, right? Volume is a cubic function, whereas area is a square function. And that's illustrated here using the just perfect cubes as an illustration, just to make it easier to think of mathematically. An individual cube, if it were just one by one by one, and it doesn't even matter what unit you're using, just it's one unit by one unit by one unit. What's the surface area of it? No. Surface area is 6, because each face of that cube is one square area, and you have 6 of them. So it's 6 square areas, square units in surface area. The volume, on the other hand, is 1 cubic unit, right? 1 times 1 times 1. Now, if you make that cube double in size in all three dimensions, now it's 2 by 2 by 2, right? So before you do that, the surface area to volume ratio would be 6 to 1, right? Now let's double it. What is the surface area? No, haven't heard it yet. Well, what's the area of one face? 4, and therefore what's the total area? 24 square units. And what's the volume now? 2 cubed, which is what? 8. Right, so now the surface area to volume ratio is 24 over 8, which simplifies to 3, right? It was 6, now it's 3. The point here is that the surface area to volume ratio goes down as you increase the size of the cell in all three dimensions, and that's because volume grows more quickly than surface area when you increase the size, and therefore it overtakes it eventually. Well, the reason this is important for a cell is that a cell, thermodynamically speaking, is an example of what's called an open system. All organisms have to be open systems, which means that they can't exist in isolation from their surroundings. They have to always be exchanging both materials and energy with the surroundings, that's really what it means to be an open system. And what part of a cell does this exchange take place at? The surface, right? That is the boundary between the organism and its surroundings, or the cell and its surroundings. So, in order to have a sufficient amount of exchange with the surroundings, a cell has to have a big enough surface area for its given volume. That's why surface area to volume ratio is so important. And if you make a cell too big, you now have a volume that is going to require so much exchange that you don't have enough surface area for that exchange to occur. And this is why you don't have huge cells. You don't have huge unicellular organisms. To be big, you have to maintain high enough surface area to volume ratio, and you do that by making your body out of multiple tiny cells rather than one huge cell. Each individual cell now still has a high surface area to volume ratio, and it can exchange things with its surroundings, which in this case includes other cells of that same organism. Okay, now in 6, we're looking at a close-up view of a single cell. It looks maybe like multiple cells here on the edge, but this is all one cell. We're really close up. This is the main part of the cell, and this is a cell from the lining of your gut. Your small intestine looks like this, the wall of it, the inner wall. And so the space above, that would be the lumen of the tube, means the hollow part of the organ. That's where it's no longer called food at that point, it's called chyme, but that's where the stuff that you ate is now passing by. It's outside of your body still. It needs to be absorbed into your body. That's the main job of the small intestine. Doing that requires a lot of proteins that act as transport proteins. And the more proteins that you have to make and embed in the membrane, the more machinery that takes up. So you could make a big cell, but the bigger the cell you make, like we just talked about, the more the surface area to volume ratio goes down. Surface area is really important to an absorptive cell because it's the surface at which absorption takes place. So what has evolved is a tactic used by the cell in which the surface area is greatly enhanced without really increasing the volume. And to do that, instead of just having a smooth covering like most cells do, the surface that faces the food is wrapped back and forth many times into what are called microvilli. A villus is a finger-like projection. That word is used over and over. So a microvillus is simply a small finger-like projection. These are subcellular structures. Each one of them is just part of this overall cell. If you think about this in two dimensions, and if you think about this as an island with a coastline, a beach that you would walk along, notice that it would be much less of distance if it were just a straight shot. But if you had to walk all the way along each one of these, you would go a much greater distance to get from A to B here. Well, similarly, there's a lot more membrane here than you would use in a smooth cell, and the more membrane you have, the more opportunity you have for absorption. But because of the spaces between, you're not really adding all that much volume. By the way, I said that earlier that you can't grow a cell in all three dimensions indefinitely because of surface area to volume ratio constraint. But notice that there are some cells in which one or two dimensions is exaggerated. A neuron, for instance, in your body. Some neurons, you know, there's a neuron running from my toe all the way up to my spinal cord. That's a single cell, extraordinarily long, but it's not very wide and it's not very deep. So just one of those three dimensions gets long, and therefore it doesn't have much of a volume because it's so thin on the other two dimensions, and therefore still has a high surface area to volume ratio. Okay, now to 7. We're looking at a typical prokaryotic cell here, which are mostly bacteria, but archaea, remember, are prokaryotes as well. In any case, it is a prokaryotic cell because of the absence of membrane-bounded organelles, like we've discussed. Go ahead.
So for example, you gave where there's a neuron that runs from your toe to the
spinal cord. Yeah.
I imagine that if it's really that thin, it could break off easily. Is there like some extra covering?
Yeah, there is connective tissue covering around each neuron, but there also, what we call a nerve, is many neurons bundled in parallel, side by side, so that gives it strength as well. See, so each individual neuron is wrapped, and then you have bundles of neurons that each bundle is wrapped, and then many bundles making up the overall nerve, and that has it's a third wrapping. So it keeps it from breaking under normal circumstances. If you have a prokaryotic cell, you don't have any of these membrane-bounded organelles, and therefore, inside the plasma membrane, which is the only membrane it has, you really have only one compartment. And that compartment includes everything else other than the membrane and anything that's exterior to the membrane, and that the contents of that compartment collectively is called the cytoplasm. That's different from our own cells, right? Our own cell, well, except for our red blood cells, for instance. A typical human cell will have a nucleus, and therefore it will have its own cytoplasm, but the cytoplasm is all the stuff that's outside of any membrane-bounded organelle. So in addition to the cytoplasm, you have other compartments, like the nucleoplasm inside the nucleus. You don't have that here in prokaryotes. Now, the nucleoplasm in a eukaryotic cell, of course, is where the DNA is, because that's one of the functions of the nucleus, is to house that DNA. Prokaryotes don't have a nucleus, but of course they have DNA. They have to have their own DNA. The DNA is just part of the cytoplasm in this case. It's not, though, the case that it's just randomly distributed in the cytoplasm. The DNA of a prokaryotic cell is concentrated in one region of the cytoplasm. It's just not its own compartment because there's no membrane. And so that region we call the nucleoid, literally meaning like a nucleus. It's not a true nucleus because there's no membrane enclosing it. A typical prokaryote will also have, in addition to a plasma membrane, a cell wall exterior to that that is manufactured by the bacterium as in part of its development. And a cell wall, just like for a plant, which also has a cell wall on its cells, allows for much greater rigidity and prevents rupturing or lysis of the cell in the face of a hypotonic environment. We'll have to stop there.